The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Well, it's nice to have you in my bedroom this evening and to practice with you. It's a funny thing, and I'm seeing some new faces and familiar faces from many different parts of the country. I saw someone from Bolivia last period. We've got Oregon and Massachusetts and New Jersey and different parts of the city. I've been feeling like your faces are very familiar to me, and I've been feeling even quite intimate with you with all the sitting that we're doing together in the morning and in the evening these days, even though a number of you I've never met in person. It's a strange thing. It's something I've noticed when we sit together at the Zendo on retreat. We can sit together in silence, walk together, eat together, work together in silence. And there develops this sense of intimacy, even though we exchange few words, we may not know each other too well, we may have very different backgrounds, different views on the world. And yet that intimacy somehow mysteriously develops. I would not have expected this to happen with Zoom, which in the beginning assumed would be quite an alienated experience. And yet that's not really the experience I'm having with our practice together this way. This is the issue that I think is one of the important issues for us right now, is looking at the issues of separation, alienation right now, as we are in seclusion, quarantine, and lockdown, and the issues of connection and intimacy. So that's what I'd like to talk about tonight. I feel like we're living in calamitous times. I notice when I have any extended conversation with people, it's very easy for the conversations to start to spiral down with all of the horrifying news that we hear about from day to day. And in those conversations, I sense a lot of fear, distress, despondency, despair. I've been very sad to hear about the losses of people close to us in the Sangha, but a colleague at work just lost his father to COVID-19. This was a man who had immigrated to the country from Greece in order to be closer to his children and grandchildren. And I worry about the students who I'm working with in the university who are graduating to a devastated job market. So there are all of these things going on, which are hard not to find distressing and to cause despair. So I was thinking about what can we do about the crisis? And, you know, one thing I think we can do is to try to learn from it. What is it that we can learn from this? And I was reminded of the work of a Bolivian thinker, a political theorist named Rene Zavaleta Mercado, who developed the idea of the crisis as method. His idea is that a crisis is a time for us to actually see ourselves more clearly and see our connections and our limitations more clearly. It's a time when a society can see itself more clearly. It's a time when we can know ourselves. So he gave different examples of this, but one was from the 1930s, Bolivia fought a war with its neighbor Paraguay, the Chaco War. There was a lot of people who died in that war. It was the largest military fatality in the history of the Americas, I think, other than the Civil War. And what the crisis showed then was how underdeveloped the country was economically. There were no internal markets that allowed the country to really stage a war. The state was clearly lacked the capacity to wage a war on its borders. All of the internal conflicts and hierarchies within the country were also exposed. So the working class, the peasantry, indigenous peoples were essentially sacrificed in tens of thousands on the part of the elites during the war. And so all of that caused, and Bolivia ended up losing the war. And that defeat caused a kind of crisis of consciousness in Bolivian society. It was evident that there was no real national identity, no real nation. And it triggered a set of social reforms and a process which eventually led to a national revolution in the 1950s, in which the country really was changed and developed in a more consolidated national character. And I think that by the same token, we can see this crisis as something that exposes us to ourselves. Gesho gave a wonderful talk recently about body exposed to the golden wind as a time when the self can see the self. And that the crisis now, I think, is a time when society can see society and self can see self. And what is it that we're seeing now? Well, we were seeing that even the most powerful economy in the world is tremendously precarious. And we're seeing how the political dysfunction in the country makes it impossible to really attend to the suffering that's going on. And we're seeing how the class and racial divisions within the country have effects that are uneven throughout society. So just here in New York City, the data that I saw from last month is that blacks in New York City are dying at a rate which is double that of whites. Latinos are dying at a rate which is 50% higher than the rate of whites in New York City. Native Americans. I didn't realize that if you look at the mortality per capita after New York and New Jersey, the highest mortality in the country is in Navajo country. So this is who we are. This is what we are. We can see ourselves right now. And we are exposed to ourselves. And so then the question is, well, what can we do about it? And of course, there are a lot of things that we can do about it. Although there's also, I think, sometimes a great sense of powerlessness. And it's true that in some ways we are overwhelmed. We're not in control. And yet there are things that we can do about it. We can make contributions to organizations that are doing good work. we can lobby and pressure our political representatives. We can, some of us are working in the healthcare field right now. One Sangha member mentioned that she and her husband were spending a lot of time working at the food pantry where they live upstate. And we can give a donation to the Village Zendo for Work for Dharma Day. In a way, there are a lot of things that we can do. I think there's another way to approach this, though, and that is not looking at it from the perspective of the self, knowing the self, but more from a Zen perspective, a radical Zen perspective, which is that of the self not knowing the self. And ultimately, I think these two views are not at odds with each other. But let's look at the other side. And to do that, I'd like to invoke an old Chinese teacher, Master Dizhang, who lived in the late 9th to early 10th century. And Dizhang is not the most famous of the old Zen masters, but he actually was quite important. He was the teacher for Fa Yang, who went on to establish one of the five houses of Zen. And he's actually, I think, very close to us here at Village Zendo. He's an important reference for us in terms of what we could call the house style. And that is the Enkyo Roshi's teaching of intimacy. There are different stories about Dizhang, and I'd love to have more time to look into all of them. But one story I'll mention is Dizhang was, one of the things about Dizhang is that he was never really striving to be a prominent Zen teacher. He was quite humble, and maybe that's part of the house style too here at Village Zendo. He was not at a major temple. He was at a small temple outside of a city. And one winter, a group of monks came, and in the cold weather and the snow, they decided to stop at his temple. They asked him if they could stay there. He said yes. And they settled in and proceeded to ignore him. They assumed he was nobody. They were coming from an important Dharma center. But at a certain point, Dizhang went over to them and said, "Would you mind if I asked you a question?" And they said, "Sure, if you'll go right ahead." And he said, "Would you say that the mountains and rivers and great earth are separate from or identical to you elders?" And the head monk in the group said, "Separate." "Are you separate from or identical to the mountains, rivers, and great earth?" And the monk said, "Separate." And Dizhang just held up two fingers. And that kind of rattled the guy, and he said, "Wait, identical." And then Dizhang held up two fingers again. And then he just walked away. And the monks were a little perturbed by this, but they didn't pay too much attention to it. They assumed he was really know what he was talking about. And they ended up leaving when the snow died down. But one of them, Fa Yang, thought, "Well, wait a minute, maybe there's something there that guy has. Maybe I should go back and look into it, investigate it a little bit more with him." And so he did. And he ended up staying with Dizhang for many years, and eventually awakening with him and receiving the Dharma from him. And the others in the pack eventually made their way back to Dijon too. And at one point, Dijon approached one of the monks and he said, where are you from? And the monk answered, from the south. And Dijon said, and how is Buddhism in the south? And the monk said, oh, there's great discussion. And Dijon said, oh, and how can that compare to me here planting the fields and growing and eating rice? And then the monk said, well, what can you do about the world? And Dijon said, and what do you call the world? So Dijon, again and again in these koans, he's the one who's asking the questions. The monks don't come to him. He goes to them. Where do you come from? The monk took that as a very straightforward question and really missed the deeper point. Master Dogen commented on this koan. He said, that is not a geographical question, he said. So we could all ask ourselves, where do we come from? But the monk didn't get the question. He said, I come from the south. And so Dijon tried again with him and said, okay, and how is Buddhism in the south? And the monk said, oh, there's great discussion. Rather boastful, assuming that the these lofty conversations they were having about the Dharma were so important, certainly much more important than what this fellow was doing out in the backcountry. He completely, again, missed the opportunity that Dijon gave him. Ultimately, what is the difference between Buddhism and the South, or the North, or the East, or the West? So Dijon generously then took a step forward and said to the monk, okay, and how can that compare to what I'm doing here, planting the fields and growing and eating rice? So Dijon finally exposed himself and showed his guts. Dijon had no doubts about who he was or what he was doing. He had no sense that his ordinary affairs were any less than those going on at any major temple at the time. And so the monk was taken aback and asked, perhaps a little defiantly, or maybe sensing that Dijon knew something, he said, and what can you do about the world? And others have translated this differently. What can you do about the 10,000 things? So here's a question for each one of us. What can you do about the world? What can you do about the 10,000 things? So with that question, Dijon basically completely blew away the monk's dualistic thinking. He blew away any idea of the separation or the alienation between the self and the world. How much of our distress and our despondency and our despair has to do with our ideas about the way the world is and the way the world should be? When Dijon blows away those ideas, he creates a possibility for relating to what's happening right now that is much more open, that is much more free, and that can be much more engaged, actually. So the verse on this koan, one of the lines says, planting rice and making rice, ordinary household affairs, only those who have investigated to the full can know. And here's a point for us. Now that we're here in seclusion and reduced to really pretty elemental aspects of our life, you know, cooking and cleaning, sitting and eating, working too, communicating too with friends. I think we need to look at our tendency to devalue these ordinary household affairs. And we can learn something from Dijong, who's saying, no, let's not do that. Let's not assume that our ordinary household affairs are any less than any others that are going on right now around the city or around the country, in other Zen centers, in other communities, in other spheres. And Master Dogen wrote a poem about this koan, and he said, with words and ideas obliterated, the light suddenly appears. So, I think this is a time when we can also appreciate that letting go of our pre-established ideas, letting go of our assumptions about the world and our relationship to it, doesn't necessarily mean complete emptiness, complete blankness. Instead, it opens up the possibility of complete intimacy, an intimacy that we lose when we're so trapped in our thoughts about what's going on. The kind of intimacy we can have when we're sitting together, kind of intimacy that we can have in this very moment if we let go of the thoughts. Fayan one day was getting dressed to leave the monastery, and Dijong saw him and said, where are you going? And Fayan said, I'm going on pilgrimage. And Dijong said, and what is your purpose in going on pilgrimage? And then Fayan stopped, and he was quiet for a moment, and he said, I don't know. And Dijong said, yes. Not knowing is most intimate. I think right now, in the midst of this crisis, is a good time to really see ourselves and really see our society with clear eyes and not just from preconceived notions. It's a time for us to really appreciate our ordinary household affairs, without devaluing them, as if there could be something more. And it's also for a time for us to practice completely intimately with the world. And when we do that, we can be intimate, without knowing it, perhaps, with the 10,000 forms and phenomena. We can be intimate even with those who are ailing and vulnerable in New York City and the Americas and the globe, as we will be in a minute when we hold our service if we give ourselves wholeheartedly to that service. We can even be intimate with those who have departed, as we will be this Sunday in our memorial service for those who've died and for Tori's father, Mark Mordecai Steiner, on the 49th day of his passing. Thank you.